Okay, hello.
Excuse me, this is the operator. I'd like to remind all participants this call is being recorded. If you do have any objections, you may disconnect at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Bob Mountain, I joins.
Could somebody do a roll call, please?
Yes, I can do that. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the IRTP call today on the 3rd of May. On the call, we have Michaela Nalan, Mike O'Connor, James Bladel, Barbara Steele, Kevin Erdman, Badwin Chombe, Paul Diaz, Matt Serlin, Simonetta Batikir, and Bob Mountain. And from staff, we have Marika Koenigs and Christina Nordstrom. And apologies, we have from Anil George, Oliver Hope, and Chris Chaplow. And may I also remind you to please state your names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you very much.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. And as per usual, does anybody have an update to their statement of interest or declaration of interest? Have you all, have any of you become communists since we last spoke, basically? No? Okay, right. Well, welcome back, Marika. I believe she was off gallivanting last week, so she wasn't with us. So, Marika, are you back? Are you now all fresh and ready for action?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, now we have to say that again with a bit of confidence now. Come on. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
That's better. That's better. You've got the fancy job title and everything, so, you know, you need to be, you know. Okay, then, on today's agenda, we are going to have a quick look at the EAC, just any revisions from last week, and then we're going to move on to a couple of other items. Mikey and James, do we have any revisions or changes to the EAC document since last week?
Excuse me, Barry Cobb now joins.
This is Mikey. I'm going to actually throw the baton to James because I did not touch the document this week.
Okay. James?
This is James. Thanks, Mikey. I have also not made any changes to the language of the EAC. I did post a note, however, and I think Mikey had a good follow-up to the mailing list, and I apologize for the delay on that. I was waiting for some feedback. But anyway, so that's out there relative to ensuring that both the what are the terms we're using? The registrar raising the EAC and the registrar responding to the EAC message are copying some neutral third party, either the registry or ICANN or possibly both. Mikey suggested that a mailing list could serve us in the interim, and then possibly we would look at this as an enhancement to Radar. But I think that the general point of my recommendation was that this cannot just be a conversation between two registrars who may or may not be involved in a dispute. There has to be an observer or referee or whatever we want to call this role to determine whether or not the EAC was raised within a certain time frame and responded within a certain time frame. And it cannot just be one registrar's word against the other registrar. So that was my only concern, and it was not a direct change in the language. So if there is some place that we can efficiently and cleanly shoehorn this into the existing document, I'm all for it.
Okay, then. I've got to see Bob. Anybody else want to throw their hat into the ring? Okay, Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. This is Bob speaking. James, I just guess just one question. Is email, considered a secure enough, method of communication to be used in this kind of application? And I'm just concerned, people having the ability to say, I sent it, but it wasn't received, or something along those lines. So I wonder if there's precedent for this type of thing elsewhere.
Well, I would say I wouldn't necessarily say email is always secure and reliable. However, I note that most of our relationships with the GTLD and CCTLD registries involve some sort of a normal and urgent communication channel. So I think it would be as secure and as vulnerable as those existing channels.
Bob?
No, that's fine. I know it's not perfect. I was just wondering if that's in practice elsewhere, then I'd say it's, you know, my guess is where it's a step in the right direction. So,
Mikey,
this is Mikey. I'm sort of winging this, so this may not be the right thing to do. But one of the things that I did in a very early draft of this was to insert language in the TDRP that was essentially a documentation step in the process. I called it, in the TDRP there are, I think, three levels, and I called the new level level zero, which would be essentially exactly what James is describing here. It was simply the process of documenting the exchange between the registrars, but there was no other action or implication to that. And I just throw that back in the hopper. I'm not, you know, I have to look at it. Since James's note came right before the call, I'm not sure this is right, but that's at least a thought that we could throw into the pile on that one.
Mr. Blizzell?
Hi, Kelly, thanks. Just wanted to follow up a little bit on Bob's question and concern. Yeah, I think that there's two questions here. One is relative to security, and one is relative to reliability of email as the EAC channel. My thinking was that for security, that's easily addressed by not putting any sensitive information in the request for an EAC and just handling that once the communication is established through other means, whether it's telephone or something else. So is it really just a reliability of delivery or the timeliness of delivery that we're concerned about with regard to using email for this channel?
That would be my concern, and also, you know, the kind of, I guess, the reliability and, you know, in the case of, you know, some kind of fallout or dispute, is it sufficient enough to hold up? I guess if there were an issue that were to, you know, come into play later on. I don't have that. I'm just sort of, you know, just using common sense. I don't have any experience that it's not. I'm just wondering aloud if that is sufficient. So.
Okay. Yeah, and I think it's probably not. Like you said, it's probably not perfect, but it's being used now in other contexts. So if we find a better method in the future for those contexts, we can certainly extend it to EAC as well.
Right.
I just put myself in the queue. With respect to, I mean, what James is saying about email and CCTLDs, and I mean actually a lot of the registries, our experience as well would be that a lot of our communications with them are a hell of a lot more efficiently done via email, especially when you have some of the registries who are in totally different time zones. So you might send them an email during office hours and you might not get an answer until sometime in the middle of the night. In terms of tracking and logging, well, if push came to shove, you'd have a log on your mail server. So even if it wasn't received on the other, on the far side, there still would be a log. Simonetta, go ahead.
Oh, I didn't even raise my hand. I just put a question in the chat, and because I missed the last two calls, and I was wondering, is this about this initial contact from one registrar to another, or is this about once you have come to a conclusion and you want to inform the registry of...
Okay, the entire thing with the EAC was is establishing the contact. And while the phone call idea, I believe, is still there, the point being that because we need to make sure that the thing is tracked, that an email would also need to be sent. But I will let Mikey explain that.
My only concern with the email would be that I don't know how the email would, like, wake somebody up in the middle of the night and establish a quick contact, because I mean, I know myself, I wouldn't read my emails at night. And if I'm on emergency call, I would still want to sleep that night and not just stay up in case someone hijacks the domain name at my registrar and I need to watch my email queue all night. So I wonder how this, like, prompt to actually wake up and do something would happen if the thing just comes in through email.
Mikey?
This is Mikey. The way the language reads right now, the goal of the EAC is to establish a telephone conversation. And I'm speaking a little bit hesitantly because I think you raise a good point that I probably need to think about more. I guess in, at least in my own experience, if I had one kind of email that I had to wake up for, if I, this is, again, I'm doing a lot of on-the-fly thinking today, but, you know, what I would do is build a filter in my email system that alerted me 24/7, and I would turn off alerts on my email, all other email, so that it would wake me up. But I'm pretty sure I don't want to write that into the policy. So I guess the question is, I mean, you know, the email conversation that we've been having up till now, as McKaylee pointed out, is primarily a documentation step. And I don't think that the language is necessarily explicit about what the actual channel mechanism is. I think we leave that up to the registrars. But we could get more explicit if you guys want.
Let's just kind of make this kind of, to summarize a little bit what we have discussed previously, and just if somebody could please jump in if I've completely misremembered things. We want the email in order for tracking, logging, and compliance, correct? And the idea of the phone call is to wake somebody up in the middle of the night if required. But but both actions need to be done. Is that right? Am I missing something?
This
somebody.
Is Mikey. I'm quickly opening up the document so that I can respond. Sorry.
Vanessa, go ahead.
I'm wondering if it might be sufficient to just mention that you should call and email. And, I mean, then the contacts that would have to be in some kind of list for this emergency channel would have to be both an email address as well as a phone number. And, I mean, it's in the interest of the registrar whose domain name got hijacked, who has the screaming client on the phone, that they do whatever they can to actually get in touch with the other side, and they would probably want to place the phone call, and then they should also email to document that they have started an attempt to contact the other side. So it's probably, maybe we're overthinking this, and if we just put in that you should do both and make sure that this list for the contacts contains both a phone number as well as an email number, probably fine.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah, I just saw Barry's comment below, but we have that set up as well on some of our emails for service, where if it's to a specific address, it drives a page to somebody who's on call, and I wonder if that would be an approach that would work for, in this case, where if it's an emergency action channel email, it drives a page to whoever happens to be on call, and that way, it's actually another way to log that the call's been made.
Guys, I'm going to cut this off here, I think. This is a policy development process, not a process development process. So, I mean, the technical specifics of how any registrar wants to implement this is something which is up to the registrar. in order for you to be an ICANN accredited registrar, you need to meet certain technical criteria. So either you have the skills in-house to do this or not. But I don't want for us to go down this rabbit hole of getting into specifics of specific technologies that should not be part of the policy. James.
I agree, McKelly. The main point here is that there should be a third party witnessing the exchange. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, look, if you want to have a fucking carrier pigeon to send through the thing through to you, so be it. If that works for you. But the thing is that we hopefully will not be kind of revisiting this in, 6 months' time. So, we don't want to be specifying too much. And yes, Bob, we do use carrier pigeons sometimes, but only in jest. Anyway, okay, can we kind of all more or less agree of that, on that? Well, there's also RFCs related to pigeons, which I think is pertinent. Okay, moving on beyond this, is there anything else related to the EAC that anybody wants to raise at this time? No? Okay. James, go ahead.
Yeah, just real quickly, we did have a suggestion last week to include some sort of a follow-up in IRTPE, whichever one is last, to see how this is going. And to adjust if necessary, so that we can get some trial on this program.
Okay. Does anybody have any issues with that concept? Okay. Moving, Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. I'm wondering if it makes more sense to put actually a timeline in instead of saying review it in IRTPE, as at this stage you have no idea when that might happen. I basically say something more like, 1 year after implementation or 6 years after implementation, this should be reviewed. So there's a more concrete timeline for when this would be reviewed instead of a very uncertain timeline. I see James assuming IRTP in 12 to 24 months. I would just like to point out that I think this one is almost going on for 2 years now. So we still have D and E, which would take us to 4 years from now if we would continue on the same rate. So that's why I'm saying maybe it's better to pinpoint a timeline saying X amount of time after implementation if the idea would be that you want to review it within 12 months or 24 months after you start using the EAC.
Okay. Mikey's supportive of that. Is there anybody who is not supportive of the idea of setting some kind of fixed time? All right, we'll take it then that everybody likes the idea of setting a fixed time to see how this is going. And then to adjust as people see fit. Okay. Anything further on the EAC at this time? Bob?
Yeah, I just wasn't sure. We had talked last week about inserting some language about reasonableness around the length of time in which it could be invoked. I just wasn't sure if that was put in or not, or if that was something we're going to do later on.
Well, what kind of language were we meant to be putting in?
Remember, that was the discussion we said around infinity versus some time less, and James's suggestion was we put some wording in there that it had to be a reasonable amount of time, so we would avoid that.
Okay. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Barbara?
This is Barbara. I actually had a different comment.
That's okay.
Are you ready for me then?
Work away. Go on.
Okay.
We don't come back to the other thing. It's all right.
Okay. Well, basically, I'd had the opportunity to talk to some of the other registries regarding the timing of registries taking action to undo transfers in the event that the other registrar does not respond. And just as I suspected, Some of the smaller registries who may not have large staffs or may even use other operators to perform their back-end services did have some concerns about the timing with which within which they were expected or would be expected under the EAC to undo a transfer. So I just wanted to go on the record that there are some concerns there, and that would be something that we would need to work through and, you know, perhaps recognize that a one-size-fits-all model may not be appropriate. I think some of the larger registries are a little more comfortable with it because, you know, they tend to have probably more of a likelihood that there would be a hijacking that would occur within their zone anyway. So I just think we need to be conscious of that when we're drafting language here.
Okay. Marika and then Mikey. Sorry, Mikey, I always give preference to ladies, you know that.
It's no problem.
Yeah, this is Marika. Apologies for missing last week's call, but I'm also wondering whether you addressed the question of what, you know, what consists of urgent communications or what is, because I think it's a discussion we had have had in relation to other issues where a definition or some kind of examples will be helpful, I think, especially from a compliance perspective, where they could refer to if someone says, well, I use it for this situation, saying, well, that is not considered urgent. Look at these kind of examples. These are the kind of situations we would consider urgent. So I don't know if that was further discussed or whether that needs to be further discussed.
Okay. Mikey, are you speaking to this point or to another point?
This is Mikey. I'm actually multitasking, and so if you want, you can just drop me out of the queue, and I'll sort of pick it up again. I was in the queue for Bob's point.
Okay. Well, I think let's try to be a little bit more logical. I'll skip you, and I'll come back to you in a minute. James, I think you're dealing. You probably put your hand up in relation to Marika, so go ahead.
Marika and Bob's comment, if I can just take a swing to both those. You're absolutely right, Bob. I apologize. We did say that we wanted to include some concept of reasonable and reasonable and practical or something like that language in limiting the time frame. And I think that this also goes to somewhat of what Marika was saying is the definition of what constitutes urgent. If it's beyond a couple of years old, then really stretching the definition of urgent or emergency. I guess, you know, I think from where I'm standing here, I would really hope that this is at or very close to the last draft of this language and that we can put a bow on this topic and all of the discussions that came before it and move on. I think, Marika, I don't know that we can define in advance what urgent looks like. I think that we'll know it when we see it. We'll certainly know when someone is abusing it for non-urgent issues. And I think that those are types of things that we're going to have to rely a little bit on mob justice for things like that because the registrars certainly know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, and I'm sure that will extend to use of EAC as well. So, you know, I kind of would like to see if we can put Bob's concern, reasonable and practical, back in here where it is appropriate and then sort of begin to drive this towards completion. I was reading the draft. I don't see a quick place to insert that. I think it's going to be a separate sentence. So, you know, I don't see where it cleanly drops in. But otherwise,
Bob was the person suggesting it, so how about Bob sees if he can come up with some wording and he can follow up on the list and let's drive this home. Bob, are you okay with that?
I'm totally happy to do that.
Perfect. Okay. Moving on. Anything further on the EAC? This is the last call. So we can move on to the next item on the agenda. Fine. There. Sorry, the screen's going mad here. Okay, then. The next item we were looking at is... There. Sorry, things getting uploaded very quickly. My screen changes. I'm completely confused. This is in relation to James's email. There's a couple of things to do with 60-day locks. Okay, as discussed, you can read it there on the screen. One of these was 60-day lock following a previous transfer. We note that the problem of domain transfer hopping between registrars was a known issue and could be used to thwart anti-hijacking issues, as well as create other enforcement slash takedown problems. We noted that the 60-day post-transfer lock is optional, which in the current IRTP is reason for denial number 9, and that most large registrars follow this practice, but that it is not mandatory. In other words, even though it is optional, most of the large registrars enforce that, so it's more a case of the exception being around, or anyway, you know what I mean. Okay, so the three what he's suggesting are three options. One, leave this topic untouched in our recommendations. Two, create some language that indicates this is a voluntary best practice. Or three, create some language for inclusion in the IRTP that makes this mandatory for all registrars. Having discussed this internally, I can report it perhaps to be option number three, etc., etc., etc. Now, what do other people feel about this? Simonetta.
I don't want to be difficult, but this is one of the ones where I feel the aftermarket players would think it is kind of overdoing it a little bit.
Can I counter that by just asking one simple thing? If you would recognize the fact that the largest registrars already do this,
right,
then how can you say that the aftermarket has a problem with this?
Well, it is one piece that aspects of the aftermarket use in certain cases to facilitate some of our processes. Like, for example, when you think about auctions for expiring names and items like this, where the customer who acquires a name would like to be able to move this name at some point. I don't think people I know dislike that the name is stuck with whichever registrar it's at this point in time and would like to be able to move this name into wherever they hold the rest of their portfolio at that point in time. So at the moment, it is possible to work out agreements with certain registrars to facilitate.
Okay, can I just one second now, Simonetta? You're talking about, you're saying this lock is only referring to a domain that has transferred within the last 60 days. So how does that affect expiring names? Because they wouldn't have been transferred.
Well, if you do purchase a domain through SnapNames or NameChat, for example, and you would like to consolidate your portfolio all in one place, you cannot do this when this thing is locked down. You could be having an agreement with the registrars that you do expiring auctions with to say, okay, all the ones that you have within your accreditation, once we sell a name for you like that, we want to be able to immediately move them on behalf of our client to elsewhere.
No, but okay, Simonetta.
It's possible if you can do this, if there is an ICANN policy that says this is not permitted, then that goes away.
Okay, Simonetta, the lock at present is to do with transfers. It's to do with a domain that was previously transferred. So if a domain is expiring with registrar A and you acquire the domain on the drop through registrar A, where's the transfer?
The transfer happens after the acquisition and then the new
owner hasn't been transferred in the previous 60
right.
days.
So
what's the problem?
The problem is that the new owner cannot do anything with this domain for 60 days. They cannot really list it for sale because they cannot transfer it to the next person, for example.
That's true for
any one domain transfer. Anyone who is purchasing and selling names for a living, this is what they do. The expiring thing was one example, but any one domain transfer you do, you would like to be able to transfer the name and immediately be able to list it for sale again and then transfer it out to whoever the new buyer is. And some of our clients have agreements with their registrars that I can call up my rep at whoever registrar and tell them, oh, I've just sold this name, and they'll make it happen for me that I can move it back out. And if you make this a rule that this is in general principle never possible anymore, then this is disturbing the aftermarket. So I don't know if we have enough of an issue with hijacking to mandate this in this policy.
James?
Okay, so very quickly, I want to be certain that we're not confusing different types of locks, transfer locks. We're speaking specifically here of the second transfer, not the first, not the original transfer after an expiration or an auction or a sale, but we're talking specifically about a transfer after a transfer. So we're trying to prevent a name hopping. And, you know, rather than revisit the endless discussion of whether or not domain name hijacking is important enough to change policy, I think that, emphatically we would say yes, it is. But, you know, I just want to be certain that we're talking about the right lock. Now, we discussed this very early on, and I think that every registrar that we've spoken to not only did this, but assumed that the post-transfer 60-day lock and the post-create 60-day lock, so you know, after you create a brand new name, you can't move it for 60 days, and after you transfer, you can't move it for 60 days. A lot of registrars thought that this was mandatory already, didn't realize that this was optional because it was such a prevalent practice. What we're saying here is, you know, since everyone's kind of already operating on the basis that it is required, and only those fringe cases where it's being abusive is it actually becoming an issue, then maybe, you know, making it mandatory would close that last loophole.
Paul Diaz?
Thanks, Michaelis. Paul, I just wanted to ask the question, as Simonetta that I posted in the list, the scenario, the let's call it a domain consolidator, somebody who is trying to move domains around via transfer to consolidate in one account. Realistically, do you have any sense of how often this happens, that somebody wants to move a name between registrars multiple times so that if we made a mandatory 60-day lock period, that would really be a burden on them? Because as James has already noted, it seems to me that large registrars who account for the majority of the market are already prohibiting such practice, and we're really talking about one-offs in those few circumstances where somebody can provide all the bona fides and you know, have a special relationship to allow it to go through. So I'm just trying to get a sense of, are we now potentially undermining the greater good for the broader public by saying you can't move after your first transfer for 60 days for the benefit of basically the long tail of the marketplace?
I don't have a perfect response to you. I can just tell you that it is an issue that our transfer team deals with all the time. We have people registering domain names for a living, and they list them for sale in our marketplace and in other marketplaces. So I would assume the same issue pops up at AfterNIC, pops up at SnapNames, pops up at all these places that allow people to transfer domain names. And my operations team tells me it happens over and over that someone has just registered a name, started to list it for sale, does not wait for the 60 days before they start listing their domain names for sale. We find a buyer, that buyer needs to wait a long time before they can get control of this name, because this has just been created. Or someone is flipping a name, has acquired a name, would like to relist it for sale, and it's locked down for 60 days. And with some partners, we have agreements that we can call them up, we can fix it for the new buyer. But it does happen all the time, and I really wonder if basically making it impossible for the aftermarket players to help their clients with these acquisitions, because there is no more you can call up your registrar partner and explain to them that this lock is optional and explain who you are, explain who the seller was, have them call in and say, I'm okay and fine with this domain name transferring out right away. If this is a lockdown policy where that registrar will just say no, period, I wonder if the cases of someone hijacking a domain name justify taking this away from all the legitimate transfers that are going through because this is currently optional.
Rob, you had your hand up.
Yeah, it was, don't forget, we're not to lose sight of this is transferring between registrars, not taking control and potential ownership of it from a secondary market. You can still use a domain, irrespective of which registrar it's with by changing the name service. You can still take ownership by updating the contacts, and people like CEDO and stuff are registrars of domains in certain CLDs can presumably just hold it in a different account for the 60 days. I think the potential for saving people confusion by saying, well, it might be 60 days, it might not be 60 days, 60 days with .org, but it's not 60 days with .net. I think the confusion there is outweighed by any potential disruption to the secondary market. And I say this as somebody who does buy and sell domains.
Mass, and then Bob, and then Mikey.
Thanks, Michaela. Yeah, just to sort of add some color here, I actually had a registrar reach out to me yesterday that voiced their concern with the proposal, and they were a quote-unquote corporate domain name registrar like Spark Monitor, and they were looking to get my opinion on it. And what I said to them, frankly, was while it may create some additional operational hurdles that we have to manage, kind of similar to what Simonetta says, like if we have a client that bought a name and it transferred and they want to retransfer it, we'll have to, calendar that for 60 days or whatever. So it does create some inefficiencies there for us. But at the end of the day, I think the larger picture is more important. And to me, because we do know that multiple registrar hops are part of a hijacking, that if we just cut out that loophole altogether, then all of us will learn to live with the additional hoops that we have to jump through. So I'm completely supportive of it.
Okay, thank you. Bob, then Mikey.
Yeah, this is Bob. Two things. I think we will get pushback from domainers because they're the ones who are flipping it. And all of these aftermarket sites, the other contingent obviously is the end user themselves, and I don't think they care, right? Because they're just going to buy it and probably for the most part leave it at the site where they bought it. But I agree with Simonetta, we probably will get pushback. So I think if we agree, we just need to be prepared for that. The other thing, to James's point, we have about, probably 50 registrar partners in our network. I was amazed at the disparity in the lock policy for each one. They're all different, from 60 days to no lock at all for any period. I don't have a list, that I could share, and I probably shouldn't, disclose that information. But I think there is today, a wide range of implement, the standards on how that is implemented. So, a policy like this, would certainly change the way a lot of people do it today, based on our experience. So, that's all.
Mikey, then Simonetta.
This is Mikey, cheerfully venturing into an area that he has no direct knowledge of. But it seems to me that the following approach would work. If we had a 60-day lock, like the one that James is proposing, which, by the way, I support emphatically, so that everybody knew that this was going to happen. And now if I put myself in the shoes of an aftermarket provider like Bob's Gang or Simonetta's, what if you changed your process so that the first transfer was to you, to CETO or whatever. And that used up the number one transfer, and thus there was a 60-day lock. And then you said to your customers, if you've bought a domain, you can do anything you want with that domain, including selling it right away. But the domain has to stay in our registrar for 60 days, after which you or whoever has bought the name is free to then transfer it to their portfolio, and we'll even automate that for you if you want, like what Matt was describing. It seems to me that there are, I'm not sure this is right, but what I guess I'm saying is that the operational hurdles don't sound that high in this particular case. And so I would hope that people would do a really good job of describing operational workarounds that could be put in place to solve those problems rather than using those operational hurdles to essentially stir up opposition to a policy which I think is a dramatic improvement to the safety of domain name transfers for everybody.
Okay, Simonetta?
Mikey and James, I don't disagree with the idea that this is going to increase security in the case of hijacking. I completely support that idea. I'm also not saying that we shouldn't make any recommendation, but I am tending to say let's make this a voluntary best practice so you leave the door open to be able to help somebody in a case where you want to, and you still have the ability to do that. You currently have this ability because the policy is you can, but you don't have to. So I would just, and it's true that a lot of registrars already put the lock there, so making it a best practice, I have no issue with that, but I don't see, when I compare the number of domain name transfers that go through legitimately, where this is creating an additional hurdle versus the number of hijack cases, I think there's just a lot more legitimate transfers going through that we would create an additional hurdle for in order to make a size-wise smaller problem a little more secure. So I just really wonder if it's necessary to be that strict to make this completely mandatory, or if it's good enough to say it's a voluntary best practice and you still have the ability to have a contact with a registrar to help someone move a name quicker.
Mikey, then Matt.
This is Mikey. I'm going to respond both to Simonetta's point and the point that Bob made in the comment with this, which is, if I were a big-time domain name investor, which I'm not, by the way, I'm a little-time domain name investor, and I was dealing with CETO, pick on Simonetta, it would seem to me that what I could do is say, Dear CETO, all of my names have to go to Black Knight, because that's where I maintain all my names. And so 60 days after I buy it, I want that name at Black Knight. If I want to sell it before the 60 days is up, I know that the domain name is safe with you, my trusted partner in buying and flipping domain names. And essentially, you have to help me manage that. It seems like this is an opportunity for value-added services. It's a value, you know, it's a whole bunch of things that you could do to help your customers. And it would be a way for you to distinguish your own services rather than imposing essentially a flawed policy on everybody else who uses domain names, who has I think, very legitimate rights and concerns about the security of their names. And so I would push back to the aftermarket community and say, look, this is an innovative community that's done a lot of things with very interesting technology, and this does not strike me as a huge burden on you, which you're placing, conversely, on everybody else. End of rant. Sorry.
Mass, and then Simonetta.
Yeah, I'd just like to first off agree with what Mikey said. I think he put that very eloquently, so agree with him on that point. The other thing that I was going to just pick up on what Simonetta had said was I generally am a fan of best practices. I think they're usually a pretty good way forward. My concern in this case is that the folks that are on the phone and the larger registrars, the more reputable, well-known registrars, will, of course, if they haven't already, will most likely implement something that's a best practice like that. The folks where the problem exists today will not, so therefore the problem will still exist. So that's why I wouldn't be supportive of recommending this as a best practice. I do think that, like I said earlier, it may present operational hurdles for any number of different parties, but I think at the end of the day, it's worth it for us to, like Mikey said, make the ecosystem safer for everyone.
Okay, Simonetta?
I completely agree with what everyone has said, and I'm not trying to be difficult here. I'm trying to bring in a perspective that might be a little unique to this group, and Bob may have similar experiences in dealing with people who buy and sell domain names. And this is not just the professional domainer. This is also the person who just purchased the first name ever in the secondary market. Their expectation coming to our website or coming to any place where they see a name advertised is that, like any other purchase online, this purchase finishes with them placing a payment. Now, it's already more complicated with a domain name because usually a domain name doesn't just transfer instantly when you've made a payment. So it's already a longer process. People are getting very concerned along the process that this is taking so long. So explaining to them that purchasing a domain name is going to take 60 days until it completes in certain cases and in others it won't is going to be a hard sell to these clients. I also know from our professional domain investors that this is one of the main reasons they are upset with their registrars about. So I really just want to make sure that when we make a recommendation like this, that this perspective is taken into account and we don't create a new issue with new constituency groups being upset around a policy here for the sake of making a hijacked domain name situation a little easier to fix. Because, I mean, what happens if a domain name gets hijacked and gets taken from A to B to C to D is you still have the initial problem, the domain got hijacked in the first place. So, yes, it is more difficult to fix the situation when it keeps hopping between registrars, but it doesn't prevent the hijacking to happen in the first place. So I really wonder if placing this additional burden on one side of the legitimate use of domain name transfers is justified by being able to prevent the hopping after a hijacking has already happened anyway.
Mikey and then James.
I think expectations is a key word in what you said, Simonetta, and I'm going to push back again and say that I think that in some cases the expectations are being set incorrectly by participants in the aftermarket. You know, if the analogy that domain names are the real estate of the internet is really true, and we could debate that over beer. but let's presume it's true for at least some. The analogy would be frustration that it takes a while to transfer the title on your building when you buy it. And yet there are good reasons why it's a good idea to have checks and balances in the process of transferring titles of very valuable assets. And I think that if the expectation was set that way, that's A, yes, you can still use your building immediately after you buy it. You can put it, you can immediately control the DNS. You can immediately sell it to someone else. You have complete control over what you do with this asset. However, there's one thing that you cannot do for 60 days, and that is if the domain has been transferred, if we stick with the scenario that I described before where you've used up the first transfer to get it into the CEDO registrar, there's one expectation you can't set, and that is that you can immediately transfer it to your registrar of choice. But rather than making that expectation a bad thing, make it a good thing. And just say, look, this is a very valuable asset. You still have complete control over what happens to it. But there's this one thing that we do to increase the security around these things, which we feel is important because these things are very valuable.
James?
I know, I thought that was very well put. By Mikey, and you know, I think it goes to the heart of this portability versus security debate, which I don't know that we're ever going to philosophically be able to step out of that. I would say that you know, very fortunate that I work with both one of the largest auction platforms in the industry, as well as one of the largest anti-hijacking teams in the industry, and so I try to get a balanced perspective. And so when I weigh in on these topics, I hope that that's kept in mind, that I'm trying not to have tunnel vision on these issues, although we can discuss whether or not I'm successful at that. But you know, stepping back a little bit from this issue, I wanted to point out that I think that this working group kind of dropped the ball on this issue, because I'm hearing a lot of discussion, a lot of good points are being raised. We touched on it briefly. We put in our final report that we would like the community to weigh in on this issue. From my review of the comments, they did not. So I guess my question is, where do we go with this, folks? If we put this in our recommendations now, I think this goes to Bob's point. You know, there's going to be a lot of, folks in the aftermarket community, they're going to raise their hands and cry foul that it wasn't in earlier drafts. It's something that we've talked about, but I think that we dropped the ball a little bit, and I'm wondering, where do we put this in here so that it doesn't look like it's, those folks are kind of a little, I don't want to say the word paranoid, a little touchy already, so, you know, I don't want to look like it's a deliberate ambush. I really do think that we have a hole in our report that we need to close in such a way that it doesn't look like we're springing this on people.
Just before I go to Mikey, would it help if we were to poll the group to get an idea of where people would like this to go? In other words, whether they want to go with option 1, option 2, or option 3. Would people find that helpful or unhelpful?
I'm fine with it.
Everybody, okay, I'm getting quite a few people thinking that's not a bad idea. All right, fine. Marika, I hate giving you work, but, well, actually, no, I don't really. I kind of don't like giving you work, but I know you're better at doing these things than I am. Could you prepare a very, very simple poll to be sent to the group just to see what people's preferences are in terms of this, options 1, 2, or 3? We'll keep this very, very simple. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Rick. I think that's not too difficult to do. I can probably use a doodle poll to get that going. The other question I have on that one, when we get to our final report, I think we need to do a poll in any event also to determine the level of consensus. Because, for example, in the case of this, if everyone agrees on, option three, but one person feels very strongly about option two, you can always file a minority viewpoint. There's, there are different options outlined, I think, in the GENIS or working group guidelines that have circulated to the group that allow for, expressions of different viewpoints on certain items, even if the rest of the group, feels a certain way. So, but I'll set up a poll for this question, and then we probably should discuss at some point as well, when and how we're going to do the consensus call on the other recommendations once we've finalized them.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Marika. Mikey, please go ahead.
Oh, this is Mikey. Are we on a 90-minute call or a 60-minute call today?
Well, I thought there were 90 unless somebody told me otherwise.
Oh, okay.
I was working on that basis. Marika, have we been called back without anybody telling me?
This is Marika. I'm not aware. I'm also operating on the assumption that we have 90 minutes.
Okay.
Perfect. Paul Diaz sorry, just one second. Paul Diaz has left the room. Is there anybody else who needs to drop off now? Okay, go ahead, Mikey.
I'm back to James's sort of question to the group about process. And I think that, I need to go back and reread our draft and see what the language in the draft was. If indeed we hinted that we were thinking about this and asked for comments from the community and the community did not respond, all of which is a series of ifs I don't know the answers to because I can't get those documents open that fast, but I am concerned that we get, if we punt on this, that we get into the same sort of situation that we got into with the EAC, which is a recommendation that was made 6 years ago that we've finally gotten around to addressing in policy. I'm sort of voicing, I'm going to sort of take off my Mikey individual hat and sort of put on the BC position type hat and say that corporate domain owners have a lot of concerns about the vulnerability of the current domain name system. And I think it's a huge opportunity missed if we just punt because it was a process error. I don't know how to fix it right off the top of my head, but surely there's a way to get that fixed. And I think it would be a travesty if we got right up to the brink and then said, oh, we didn't do the process right, so we can't fix this. I think that might be my first Circle ID article ever.
Okay. Anybody else have any comments? Okay. What's the similar to? Do you know the reason why these two were so far a may and not a shall? Which ones are you referring to, Simonetta?
I'm still thinking about these lock things. I'm wondering.
Oh, where the history of them is it?
Versus, this has to be done this way. And also on Mikey's point, I don't know why this question would have any effect on the EAC idea. I kind of see them separate, but maybe
clarify, I'm saying I'm only drawing the parallel between this question and the EAC. I think they're equally important.
Okay.
And I think they're equally problematic if they are deferred indefinitely.
Okay, James?
Does someone on the group know why so far these the denial number 8 and 9 were listed as may versus shall? Does someone know?
I was actually going to take a swing at that. I don't know for a fact, but I do note the construction of the IRTP policy is that there is a list of things that require, there are a list of reasons for which a registrar may never deny a transfer, and there are a list of reasons for justifications for which a registrar may deny a transfer, but there is no section for situations or reasons where a registrar must deny a transfer. That entire concept seems to be absent from the policy. So that was my take on how to fix this, was to create a new section that says, you know, here are some situations where the transfers must be rejected. And we could probably even take them out of the idea that they would be rejected and just talk to the registries about whether they would even accept transfer requests during those periods. So that was my wild swing at some of those questions. So I think it's a good observation.
Okay, thank you. Right then. Okay then. Marika, could you load up the proposed language that we have in relation to denial reason number 6?
Give me a few seconds, please.
This is the thing we were discussing yesterday via email.
Yes, I'm looking that up. Pasted it on top of the Adobe Connect window.
Right then. So the proposed language that in the report, this is going back to denial reason number 6. So in the report at present, we have proposed the following language. Express objection to the transfer by the transfer contact. Objection could take the form of a specific request, either by paper or electronic means, by the transfer contact to deny a particular transfer request, or a general objection to all transfers, all transfer requests received by the registrar, either temporarily or indefinitely. In all cases, the objection must be provided with the express and informed consent of the transfer contact on an opt-in basis and upon request by the transfer contact. The registrar must remove the lock or provide a reasonably accessible method for the transfer contact to remove the lock within 5 calendar days. And I think one of the things that James and I were talking about offline on this was, I think it was adding the word authorized or something like that. James, go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct, Kelly. Just for the group, the background of my concern on this is I've received some feedback from other registrars and other folks within the community that, hey, does this mean product X is going to be going away, or does this mean product Y is no longer allowed under ICANN policy or something like that? Wanted to make it clearer from this proposed language that we were not aiming this at any one business model or service offering, that this was to clarify previous language. So we often talk about in these policy circles that we need to be aware of side effects, and I think that we're getting some hints that there could be side effects from this that we had not anticipated. So one possibility would be to say authorized transfer contact, and what authorized does, in my opinion, is ensures that whatever process or product is already in place that is reserved for the exclusive use of the, to authorize the person who's authorized to transfer the name will still be in place and is not changing that power dynamic between the transfer contact, the registrar, and the person who may or may not be claiming to be the transfer contact. So I'm just really trying to clarify or that's reestablished the status quo with the addition of the word authorized. And it looks like we put a lot of authorized in there. Thank you, Marika. We can probably pare that down a little bit, but I think you've got the idea.
Okay. Anybody have any thoughts on this? Mikey.
This is Mike.
Please.
This is one of those ones that I tend to defer to the registrars on. The idea is great, and I support it. But in terms of the specifics, to avoid the problem that you and James were discussing, I have to defer to people who are closer to the actual processes. And if this fixes the problem, then I'm fine with it.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? Does anybody violently disagree with the concept of adding the word authorized more than once to the text? Maybe not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Is that 5 times or 6 times? Does anybody have any issue with making that small change to the thing? Simonetta, go ahead.
I don't have an issue. I just wonder why this would be any different than the current wording. Like,
okay, the current wording is...
as just saying transfer contact, because you... I mean, this doesn't go into detail. What makes someone an authorized versus just a transfer contact? I mean, it's kind of implied. I don't have an issue. Put it in if you like to, but I don't see the difference in being able to enforce this against any kind of situation. I don't know how this would help you. But I'm completely
James,
fine to put that in there if you think this is a good change.
James, go ahead.
Just to be clear, and I don't want to give away anyone's secret recipes, but you know, if there was a, for example, a special sort of number or PIN number or security process that one would go through, and that there was some dispute over who the transfer contact was, that whatever process the registrar or other business had in place to validate, verify, or authorize the transfer contact would not be prohibited by this. So I guess I didn't, Simonetta, I agree with you. I didn't see that this would necessarily prohibit those, but I think some people were reading into the proposed language something that may or may not have been there, as to say that certain products or services would have to go away or be changed. And I'm just trying to emphasize that with the word authorized, that we wouldn't. Those products that currently exist would be untouched.
Okay.
The current wording in the current policy is much shorter. It just says, deny reason number 6, express written objection to the transfer from the transfer contact, e.g. email, fax, paper document, or other processes by which the transfer contact has expressly and voluntarily objected through opt-in means. Just so we remember what the actual original wording was. I think the part of the thing is was more to kind of clarify the language a little bit that we'd suggested the wording there. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just looking at the IRTP on other sections, because the transfer contact is defined further up in 2.1, saying either the registered name holder or the administrative contact hereafter transfer contact. So I'm not really clear either on how to authorize changes, but I'm just wondering if that would then be in conflict, because still the transfer contact is in principle limited according to the definition in 2.1, as I read it, to either the registered name holder or the administrative contact. So does adding authorized achieve what you're trying to do?
Real quickly, this is James, if I could respond. I think so, Marika. I think that the scenarios that I was discussing is when the identity of one of those contacts is in doubt, or if there's, you know, claims between, you know, competing claims between the registrant and the administrative contract. So I guess I don't really know what I'm trying to fix here. It's just that what we want to do for certain is to ensure that people don't take the wrong impression from this language as that their security product, their security service, or their, you know, super cool vault lockdown, super, you know, non-transferable system that they have paid big dollars for is now going to be worthless. So, you know, I think that what we're trying to say here is status quo, reemphasize no one's products or services or security tools are going away. And I think that also I put in the chat that really what we're looking at is the folks who can remove the lock. So really it's just the last one or two instances of the word authorized that are needed, and then the rest are probably superfluous. But no, I don't think we're trying to change the definition of transfer contact or tweak this in any way. I think we're quite the opposite. We're trying to emphasize the status quo.
Okay, thanks, James. I mean, just putting myself slightly kind of in the queue here, I mean, one of the problems that we currently have as a weakness within the system, and I mean by the system, I mean the kind of the entire ICANN policy and everything else, and we've said this in the past, is that there is no concept of a change of control. The other thing as well is, if, for example, let us say that, I mean, the kind of thing I suppose is this, is that the entire idea that the contact be authorized, so if as the losing registrar, I was to feel that the contact wasn't authorized for some reason, then I should have the ability to block that until I'm sure that contact is authorized. Right. Moving on. So anything else further on this? James, you still have your hand up. Is that an old one?
Yeah, that's coming down. Sorry.
That's okay. But you can put it up again if you want. I don't mind. Okay, then. As we're kind of coming up to, we've got about 15 minutes left. Right. Denial reason number 6. We've dealt with that. There's nothing further on that point. We will move on. Going once. Going twice. Okay, fine. Right, the public comments. Do you have those there, Marika? There, she's moved stuff away again.
Give me 1 second.
Okay.
So just a note, I actually looked through the transcript of last week's call, so I've tried to capture the discussion on those items that you covered. I would just like to, I don't propose to go through all of them now as you already discussed them, but if people could take the opportunity maybe between now and the next call to look through this document, I'll post it to the list later today and make sure that, you know, the different responses that we've put in there match our discussions, because the idea would be that this document is incorporated into the final report or linked to the final report, so those that have provided comments can actually see how these were addressed by the working group. So we'd really appreciate if you can just have a look and make sure that I didn't miss anything or, you know, got anything wrong on the basis of what you discussed last week and in previous calls.
Okay. So if everybody could actually take the time to go through this, there were a couple of items. Do I have access to move this thing? Yeah, I do. Okay. There were a couple of items that we still need to address. Examples of emergencies. This has come up more than once in the past. So if people have specific examples of what would qualify as an emergency, this would be helpful. Also, case examples of what would not qualify as an emergency, this would be helpful. Now, just a second. There's one or two things here, I think, that we just said that we needed to follow up on. I also, if you look under section 20, under 27, I think that the term seller has been used quite a few times. I think because if we're dealing with domain aftermarket, I think using the term traders might be a little bit clearer, because I suspect there might be confusion between, you know, selling versus reselling versus selling in an aftermarket scenario, which is why I made a suggestion that we just change that to traders. Monica, can you remember, there was one or two things that we needed to follow up on today, but where are they gone to?
Mark, I think one of the items we already discussed, I think that was item, let me just see where that is, on 56. I think that's the item that we just discussed, the 60-day lock following a transfer, the reason I don't know.
Okay, that was it. Okay, fine. Sorry. Yeah, because I'm looking at this thing, and for some reason I could see it on the version that I had in Word, and then I couldn't find it when I was looking on the screen for some stupid reason.
And Mark, if I can ask another question on item 64, is this something that understood from the transcript that you discussed, that maybe staff could provide further feedback on, you know, the inconsistencies between, you know, who is and what is called out in the policy? My question is that something that you want to incorporate in the recommendation, so that staff provides further clarity, or is the idea that I, you know, take this question back to the responsible staff or whoever can give an answer to that, to try to come up with that as part of the working group deliberation? I'm just trying to get some clarity on what the intent was of that comment.
Well, okay, I suppose the thing is that ICANN staff raised an issue. So if ICANN staff are the ones raising the issue, maybe they could give more you know, tangible examples of where they consider this to be an issue. So I suppose take it back to the staff member who is in charge of
this. I think there's only one example given. So, I mean, do you want to have the whole list? Or I think our, you know, as I interpret the comment, is meaning like when you need the recommendation to clarify to his status messages, the working group might also want to consider making sure that there's consistency between, you know, those terms that are defined and those that are not. So I don't know if it's more part of the implementation work to also address this issue instead of now, you know, getting that list.
Okay. Does anybody have any thoughts on this? Nobody? Okay. Right then. Any other issues related to the public comments? Because I think we've pretty much gone through all of them. Does anybody have any last final words? One thing in just when going through these, we'd also noted that a couple of the references we'd made to things like 24 hours have been updated to 4 hours. And I think there were a couple of other minor consistency things that need to be checked. But if everybody could just go over this between now and the next meeting. Are there any other matters anybody wants to raise at this time? Marika?
It is, Marika. I'll start as well as soon as I get a chance to update the proposed final report with some of the changes based on, you know, the public comments that we've discussed, incorporating the latest draft of the EAC. I understand that there's, I think, two more changes, one to the time frame and one sentence that needs to be added. I think Bob was going to make a suggestion where that should be added. And then I presume as well the FAQ that Mikey prepared would be added there. So hopefully I can get it out as well relatively soon for review, and then we probably need to discuss in the next call as well how we go about polling of the recommendations and finalizing the report for submission.
Okay. I think in that case, let's call it a day, unless anybody has any other matters they want to raise immediately. Okay, then. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Oh, wait a second. Mikey has a hand up. Go ahead, Mikey.
Just one point, and that is that I have invoked this working group's name in vain in our BC comments regarding the .NET contract renewal, and the part of our comments where we are, as a constituency, assuming this gets through the review process, going to support Thiku as a part of the contract for .NET, and I just throw that out there for others to consider for their constituencies if they feel like making similar comments. That's all.
Okay. All right, then. Anybody else have any thoughts at this time? Okay. In that case, wrap it up. Speak to you all next week. Thanks.
Thanks, McKelly.
Thanks, McKelly.
Thanks, McKelly.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.